Hello and welcome to the Combat and Classics Podcast. This is Brian Wilson in Dallas, Texas.
Shiloh Brooks at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey.
And Jeff Black at St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland.
We are almost to the end. The penultimate, which I feel like we should get rid of that word or change it a little. It's like bi-weekly. How often is that? I don't like penultimate, but
it was a replacement for post-anti-penultimate. So,
post-anti-penultimate. I actually like post-anti-penultimate better. So we are on book 23, the second to the last book in Homer's Iliad, and Shiloh is going to give us an overview and Jeff is going to give us an opening question. Over to you, Shiloh.
All right. Book 23. So our scene opens with, Achilles mourning for Patroclus. If you recall, Hector is now dead. And so Achilles had not been eating. He has a little bit of food, but and then he goes to bed, but he has this dream. And in this dream, Patroclus essentially comes to him and says, "You got to have my funeral." And so, you know, Achilles kills some Trojans and whatnot in honor of some captives in honor of Patroclus. And then he lights the funeral pyre, and there's this big sort of burial of Patroclus, but then there is, and this is the bulk of book 23, and I'm not going to go into each little detail, but there's a giant series of competitions and contests, and there's some shenanigans that go down. So there's, you know, the things that you would expect. There's a chariot race, and there's some wrestling and boxing and other things. And the chariot race in particular is focused on by Homer because Diomedes wins with the help of Athena. And there's this guy, Antilochus, who comes in second, and people are mad at him. Menelaus gets mad. Then Achilles considers, you know, stripping Antilochus's prize and giving it to the last place person. And so there's this whole, you know, in some ways interesting question about justice that occurs here. And it's not, and I know I'm getting a little bit too deep into it right now, but it's not dissimilar from some of the things that went on at the beginning of the book, namely a person having to give something back and not wanting to give it back. So at any rate, that's book 23. And if you guys want to get into some of those contests and the details there, I'm happy to do it.
Yeah. Thanks, Shiloh. I do want to get into this. And for exactly the reason that you mentioned, the thing that strikes me is book 23, it has almost 900 lines or roughly 900 lines. And of those, almost 900. And of those, the chariot race starts around line 272, and Homer describes it until around line 650. Right. In other words, it's more than 400 lines, so it's almost half of the whole book. So, you know, the book is ostensibly devoted to the funeral of Patroclus, but half the book is on this particular chariot race. So I think it is important, and I really want to look into the question that you were hinting at, this question of the justice of the chariot race. So let me tee it up this way. You know, and I'm also conscious of us being close to the end, so I'm going to try to tie some things together here. This book is supposed to be about the wrath of Achilles, and we noted a few pods ago that Achilles' wrath seems to be over in the strict sense when he and Agamemnon make up. So why does the book keep going? Well, there are some consequences to his wrath. Patroclus is dead. We might think that that means the book has to go until Patroclus is buried. But there are other consequences of his wrath. Achilles might have changed. He might be a different person having experienced the wrath that he did, about which the Iliad is. And one of the signs of a change is a very nice detail that happens in book 23. Early on, Achilles says to Agamemnon, nobody follows you among the Greeks, nobody follows you any better. You're the best leader of the Greeks. So why don't you go and gather some wood? The point is to make a funeral pyre for Patroclus. And so, you know, Achilles on the surface is telling Agamemnon, no, you're the best of our leaders. You should be foremost among us. But really, he's bossing him around. And in fact, the whole book is Achilles putting things into place for the funeral of Patroclus. And so I want to ask about Achilles' leadership. And I want to ask about it in particular in the chariot race. There's lots of detail in the chariot race. Do we think Achilles does a good job of managing the chariot race and judging the outcome?
Well, let's get the basics of it out. You know, like let's kind of go over that. Who wins, who feels slighted, and that sort of thing, and what Achilles does.
Yeah, so let's see. We have Diomedes participates.
Diomedes participates and right. wins.
And wins.
With the help of a god.
And with a slight setback, right? So first, what is it? Apollo snatches the whip or the reins or something out of his hands, and then Athena restores
exactly
it to his hands, and he wins. And he has he has the best horses, I think that said.
Which is also juiced a little bit by Athena.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Which is interesting because it's like, you know, the gods getting involved even in the games. Like, they just can't leave it alone.
Yeah, and I guess that's a question then. Did he win because he has the best horses, or did he win because of divine assistance, right? Maybe that's one piece of the puzzle. And who else have we got? We have this guy Antilochus, right?
This is where things get, this is where things get heated because folks, Menelaus and others want him stripped of his, and the reason is because what he does something in the, and I don't remember what it was, but he commits a foul.
Yeah, and in fact, scholars are really get all heated about exactly what did Antilochus do. What were you going to say, Brian?
I was, you know, hearkening back to the, you know, another piece of classical art, Days of Thunder. where, you know, Cole Trickle just mentions that that's Rubin and Rubin's racing. And that seems to be what's kind of going on here, is that he passed Menelaus in a somewhat dangerous way. And it's foreshadowed a little bit because there's a fifth racer, right, who wrecks.
Oh, yeah. Eumelus, is that his name, maybe? Yeah. Something like that? Yeah. And he crashes out. He finishes the course, right? He's leading his horses and pulling his own chariot, so he becomes the horse, you know, and crosses the finish line, which is kind of admirable.
So there's this weird thing that's going on that, you know, I think that, you know, Jeff, you're pointing to something similar with Achilles and Agamemnon and the competitions between the Greeks, and it might also point us to the competition between, or the war between the Trojans and the Greeks. Which is, you know, why is Menelaus angry? Mm-hmm. How does the giving of gifts by Achilles kind of chill things out? Mm-hmm. I mean, you kind of teed up the scholarly debate around exactly what Antilochus and Menelaus, what's going on with those two. Like, do you want to give us a little teaser there? Because I, you know, being a devoted Johnny and super lazy, haven't read any of the commentary.
I don't know how much is actually hanging on this question. It looks like, you know, Nestor gives very kind of specific instructions to his son Antilochus before the race. And he says something like this, when people have a good horse, they're just confident that they can go fast. And so they just let the horse go. And they might, you know, weave around, and they might take the turns wide. Maybe we should actually step back. So this is a U-shaped course, all right, with a very long legs on the U. And so I think part of the reason is you want them to start and end at the same place. So if the spectators are there where they begin, then they're also there where they're going to end. And so there's some post out there really distant. And the job is you start, you race out to the post, you turn around and you come back. And you can imagine if you have a fast horse, one of the things you do, you'd let the horse have its head. And that would mean a long turn. And essentially Nestor says to Antilochus, look, if your horses aren't as fast, you could be smart and compensate for their being slower by plotting a shorter course. In other words, making a tighter turn. But that means you got to be on the inside. You got to be right up against that turning post with your axle when you turn around there. And you can imagine you can't make that turn at a fast speed. You got to be relatively slow to make that turn. There might be even a disadvantage if your horses are faster because they have to slow down to make a tight turn. And so I think Menelaus and Antilochus get into it because only one chariot can fit into that tightest spot around the turning post. And Menelaus was making his turn, and Antilochus somehow wedges himself in. I haven't seen Days of Thunder, but I can imagine that exactly this is at stake in that movie too, right? That you make time by making tight turns, making smart turns. So that looks like it's what happened. The horses and the riders are endangered by this maneuver, and so it looks like a foolish attempt to win through skill while putting yourself and your fellow riders and horses teams at risk. So that's what I take to be the technical setup. So we have four participants, right? And one doesn't finish. One does finish, but last place. It's second and third place that are contested. Who should it be, Menelaus or Antilochus? And first place is clearly to Diomedes, despite the interference or because of the support of the gods. There's a fifth person who's involved. I find this to be part of the whole question of how we judge Achilles' leadership. Nestor gets a prize, even though he didn't race. With that kind of background, what do we think of how Achilles manages it? Are we any closer to having a view on that question?
I mean, end state, everybody's happy. Right. So if I want to draw my system boundary around the race and the people involved in the race, it seems like everybody's happy. But, you know, Jeff, you teed it off as saying that before we're recording that 23 was like the key to the whole book, and that the chariot race is a big part of this book. So I'm trying to stretch my brain and just say, like, what is the parallel in this race and the other scenes in the book or in the whole work or in the work itself? And so can you help me understand, is there something you're going towards in terms of parallels with this and the rest of the work, or a different scene or something like that?
Yeah, let me float a hypothesis here. I was thinking of book 23 as being Achillean domestic policy. And the particular domestic policy of the post-wrath Achilles, or if I can put it another way, the domestic policy of the dead Achilles. One of the things that's striking about Achilles in this book is he is planning his own funeral in making arrangements for Patroclus' funeral. Yeah, you'll be in this urn until I join you with my bones, right? Yeah, you'll be in this mound until they put me in the mound and then they make it bigger. Right, Achilles is vividly imagining his own death. It's very much on his mind. And then, you know, in that light, book 24 to me seems like Achillean foreign policy post-wrath, right? So the foreign policy of the dead Achilles, which has to do with this meeting with Priam, which we'll get to in the next pod. But so here's what I'm thinking. Diomedes deserves to win. It's not clear that he wins because he deserves to. Antilochus doesn't deserve to be in second place, but he essentially gets the prize for second place. Menelaus deserves to be in second place, but he ends up not getting the prize for second place and is satisfied. And, Eumelus, we won't say anything about him other than I hope he gets some ointment for that face. But Nestor doesn't deserve anything, and he gets something. So I think I agree that everybody's happy. Achilles made everybody happy. But at what cost, or on the basis of what principles, did he make everybody happy? And I'm starting to think that there are a few things at work here, one of which is pity. And another thing that's at work is skill. And I'm inclined to call these two things, pity and skill, non-Achillean and non-Homeric, that they're not characteristic of the healthy Achilles, they're characteristic of the dead Achilles. So that's where I'm going. That's my idea. So does that kind of seem to fit with any of the details that we see so far?
So he takes pity on these, on who? On...
Well, Nestor I think Nestor's the chief example of pity. I think that's explicitly a pity prize, if I can put it that way. Or the other way is, you know, Achilles doesn't just invent the participation trophy. He invents the non-participation trophy, right? You couldn't participate, yeah. So here's your award. And it's connected with how old Nestor is. Nestor can't compete in any of the events. And Achilles feels bad about that, and so he gives him a prize.
It seems like there's an interesting kind of two tracks that we can explore on this, or the potential to explore on this. And one is, like you said, the dead Achilles, right? Because what's the point of having stuff if you're going to die? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, give an urn to Nestor. You don't need it. But the second thing, I think, or at least maybe a second thing, is demonstrating the difference, and Shiloh pointed this earlier, the difference in how Achilles treats loot and Agamemnon treated loot, right? The whole start of the book is based on Agamemnon, you know, giving something away and taking it back, or not giving, you know, proper gifts to Achilles. And then we see Achilles just giving stuff away, just chilling everybody out. You know, it's foreshadowed a little bit. There's like that little argument between Ajax and Idomeneus, where they're just talking smack to each other, like in the stands, and Achilles chills them out.
Yeah.
And then we get the Menelaus and Antilochus, you know, argument. And Achilles kind of chills it out, but I think just with his approach and presence, like Antilochus and Menelaus just kind of chill out themselves. Yeah. And so he's putting a lot of oil on the waters. And is giving a very free hand in terms of prizes. And I mean, that's got to be to some degree to draw out the contrast between him and Agamemnon.
Yeah.
And the thing that makes that, so the dead Achilles I get, but it's also, you know, what we call in the Marine Corps is like Achilles has got this in his toolbox, right? Like he's got the rage of Achilles where he can go out and just slaughter people. He's got that rage of Achilles in the next book, where is it this book or the next book, where he I think it's the next book, where he kills 12 Trojan youths that he captured.
Yeah, that's this also, book. Yeah.
Oh, that's this book. Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so he's got these different things in his locker, and to mention something in 24 too. Achilles has these two long speeches where he kind of is giving history lessons to people. One to Priam, and I forget who he's talking to, the other one, but he goes on these long kind of diatribes of historical precedent. So I think that it's when Agamemnon is out of the way and not talking, which Jeff, you know, talked about in the previous pod, you know, Agamemnon doesn't have any lines in these two books. He's being commanded by Achilles. There's an interesting thing where I think he's kind of dragging his feet a little bit with the first command, which I thought was, you know, super fun bureaucratic stuff where somebody tells you what to do and they're not your boss. You just kind of drag your feet a little bit. But I guess my point is that what I'm taking from this the most is, you know, Achilles should probably have been in charge the whole time, you know, because he's demonstrating what he can do and what he's capable of when he is in charge.
Yeah. And you know, this, well, first, Shiloh, you wanted to say something. You want to go ahead?
Well, I wanted to get a little bit more clarity on the notion that pity is not Homeric. I mean, couldn't a person argue, maybe I wouldn't argue it, but it's not inconceivable to me that from the beginning, Achilles has sought pity or some such thing. I mean, it's difficult to say what, but that's in a way pity of some kind is central to the story, far from being not un-Homeric. Now I know that we'd have to get into that, but what I mean, so I guess the burden is on you to say why pity is not Homeric.
Yeah. And my inclination is to say it's not, and to say that, what Achilles was seeking by abstaining from the fighting was a kind of punishment rather than the pity of his fellow Greeks. But maybe the way to push into this and to try to defend this kind of suspicion I have is first to acknowledge that I used to feel the way Brian does, right? In other words, my reading of 23 used to be, oh, this is how good things would have been if Achilles had been in charge the whole time. And then I started to think about why it is that these things are now in Achilles' toolbox. And so the first thing I thought about was exactly the other thing Brian mentioned, right? Why is he giving away all this stuff, right? Among the prizes that he gives in the funeral games is a cup that was Patroclus's, right? So there's a bunch of stuff, and it's not just really valuable stuff, but it's also stuff that might have had some meaning to Achilles. And I think the answer's got to be that it's because he doesn't need it or want it anymore. But he used to think that those things were a kind of symbol of, or an indication of, his merit. Right? That's why the whole Wrath of Achilles started in the first place. You can't take away my woman because, you know, that means you get one and I don't get one, but my merit is greater than yours. So it looks like he's abandoned the connection between stuff and merit. And that seems to me to go together with his being dead in the sense that I'm thinking about him that I mentioned, right? That he's no longer part of this competition about who's superior. He's no longer convinced that it's of any value, I'd say. But here's another thing, and this might be the next step, and I think it goes together with what we've just observed. Should Achilles have insisted that Antilochus take the oath that he used no trickery or admit to trickery? Because remember, that's what Menelaus asks for when the race is over. You got to swear that you didn't use any trickery in this race. Should Achilles have required that to happen? It looks like he doesn't.
Could you point to the line there, Jeff?
Yeah, let's see if I can find it. It's closer to the end, which would mean it's somewhere in the 600s. Here we go. So, sorry, late 500s. Why don't I start reading? I'll read a little bit here, 566 and following. Then among them rose up also Menelaus, grieved at heart, furiously angry at Antilochus. And a herald placed the staff in his hand and ordered silence among the Argives. I take it that this is serious if the herald is getting involved. And then spoke among them the godlike man. Antilochus, once wise, what a thing you have done. You have put my skill to shame and have thwarted my horses, thrusting to the front your own that were far lesser. Come now, you leaders and rulers of the Argives, judge rightly between us two, and not with partiality, lest in future some one of the bronze-clad Achaeans shall say, over Antilochus did Menelaus prevail by deceit, and went away with the mare because his horses were far lesser, but he himself the mightier in worth and power. But I will myself declare what is right, and I think that no other of the Danaans will rebuke me, for my judgment will be just. Antilochus, nurtured by Zeus, come here, and, as is the custom, stand before your horses and chariot, and take in hand the slender whip with which you were driving just now, and laying your hand on the horses, swear by him who holds and shakes the earth, Poseidon, that not of your own will did you hinder my chariot by guile. All right, so this is what Menelaus wants. Swear that you didn't use any trickery. It's the custom, apparently, in these races. And Antilochus wriggles out of it. And by the way, he wriggles out of it in a way that leads Menelaus to give him the prize, even though Menelaus is really angry that Antilochus interfered with him. Achilles lets this go. And it looks like it absolutely has the effect that we were saying it has. It pours oil on troubled waters. It smooths things out. But I'm starting to think, at a cost, there's something dishonest about what just happened here.
I mean, it seems like Antilochus is in a lose-lose situation. Right? Because is he going to be believed if he takes the oath? Right? Is everyone in the Argives going to be like, oh, well, he swore with a whip, so it's got to be true. Or if he doesn't swear, then, you know, everybody is then going to be either like, oh, he cheated, or they're going to be mad at Menelaus. So I read that as Antilochus just being very politically savvy and just realizing, like, there's not an upside for me here. Mm-hmm. So why not just, here, take the mare, man. I beat you, but if you want to throw a hissy fit, go ahead. And right. And this makes sense to me when I think in terms of rank, right? Like, we would occasionally play like tackle football in the Marine Corps, like the whole unit. And you know, if a corporal, like, and our company commander when I started with this unit was a pretty tiny guy, who liked to play quarterback, mm-hmm. and would occasionally just get wrecked by some of the larger, faster guys that had played football. And also would occasionally complain about getting wrecked because, you know, he had this idea of his stature as a quarterback. And so, like, you know, I remember he got hit by a, you know, Sergeant Mo Hadar one time and complained about it. And Mo's like, my bad, sir. Like, I, you know, definitely shouldn't have hit you like that. And, you know, the CO looks like kind of a, you know, not like being a little bit of a whiner, I'm remembering this correctly. I could be, because I know some of my former company mates that listen to this podcast. So if I'm forgetting, if I'm changing this story, then forgive me. But it, you know, it made sense to me in terms of, you know, Antilochus just going like, all right, I don't have the rank that Menelaus has.
Yeah.
So I will just be like, no, that's fine. Here, take the horse. No, my fault. Like, I thought we were playing to win. I thought we just had to go around the post. If there were some rules I didn't know about it, please forgive me. Here, take the horse. Mm-hmm. And then Menelaus realizes that he's, you know, potentially using his rank to like bend the rules in his favor.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I kind of took this. So, I mean, that's how I read the thing. And I also, you know, wondered if Homer is doing this kind of like final scene for people, right? Because we have a lot of characters that get lines in these last two books that we potentially haven't heard from in a while, right? And they get this final scene. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these final scenes, they come off very noble. They come off very virtuous. And so I wonder if, you know, to a certain degree, Homer's kind of writing these in to kind of give these characters their final kind of scene, to put them in a more positive light than maybe they've been seen in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me maybe mention just one more thing. I know that there's so much detail here and we're at the risk of going long on this one, especially because there's so much detail, but here's just one more piece. So there are a bunch of other competitions after the chariot race, and one of them is a wrestling match between Ajax and Odysseus, and Odysseus wins also by skill, right? Odysseus can't prevail over Ajax, as we might expect, by sheer strength, but he knows some moves, and so he kicks in the inside of Ajax's knee and tumbles him the first time. And so I'm wondering if there isn't a pattern here. This is something we'd have to go, I think, through at a lot greater length, of skill replacing strength or something like that. Antilochus comes back again. There's another competition where he talks his way into a prize near the end of the funeral games. So people who are fancy talkers, like Nestor's son, and people who are clever, like Odysseus, seem to me to be moving into the forefront. And the honest, uncomplicated, simple, strong types, like Ajax, you know, the old leaders, like Menelaus and Agamemnon, they're falling into the background. And it looks to me like there's a kind of a generational change. Maybe the most humiliating thing is when Agamemnon goes to compete in the spear-throwing contest, and Achilles says, oh, we don't even have to have this contest. You take first prize. It's absolutely humiliating. Or the one time they actually have a hoplite battle, they can't even stand to watch to see what the outcome is. They call it off because they're scared that somebody might get hurt. I mean, when I start to put these details together, it really starts to bother me. Achilles is managing his fellow Greeks well, but is he doing good to them? I get the feeling that he's not.
And you take this to be a decline.
I do.
I mean, because it's not inconceivable to me that it could be viewed as an ascent past the barbaric, you know, ways and into a deepening of the spirit and a deepening of the man, or the man skill and pity. These are fairly high order complex things for a person to feel and be.
I think that that could very well be said too. Yes.
I love this because this tease up my very much like if I was Achilles and we were doing hoplite battles, like if we, you know, played football and then next it was like, all right, gear up and start shooting at each other, right. But like only wound, you know, you take a few shots, you're like, this is a bad idea, we should not be doing this.
Yeah.
And you just call it off and you call the tie. And then if like the commanding general tees up against, you know, some, I don't even remember who it was, some minor character that starts with an M, right? Which is the, this Marionis.
Yeah, yeah,
Marionis, yeah. You don't want to embarrass the general, you know? So you just say, oh, end X, sorry, it's a hard stop, we got it. But no, I mean, you were going to win, obviously, you're the best spearman, so here you go.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it makes sense to me from like a troop safety and commanding general ego mentality to do exactly what Achilles does.
I concede all these points and I still have
no and, but here's the thing, I think all of it fits. I think that's the interesting thing, and maybe why, you know, we keep coming back to Homer and people keep coming back to Homer, because I think all of these fit into the rubric that we're seeing. And so it's a little bit personal preference, and it's a little bit like, let's haggle over it on a podcast. And yeah, it's interesting. And I mean, I'm glad you brought up the Agamemnon and the spear competition, because that was definitely fascinating to me. Like you've got competition after you've got the horse race, then you got boxing, wrestling, running, a duel, you got a shot put, you got archery, and then you're going to get this, you know, big finale. Agamemnon's going to have a spear throwing contest, and they just peters out. They're just like, no, everybody wins. Here you go.
Right.
And so, you know, structurally, it doesn't necessarily make sense because you want to do the big finale at the end. But if the theme is humiliating Agamemnon, putting Agamemnon in his place, commanding Agamemnon, because Agamemnon doesn't buck. He's just like, okay. He doesn't even say anything, but he's just like, okay, yeah, I'll take my prize and be done. And so it is a little bit, you know, I see your point in terms of humiliation, because it to some degree seals the deal on Agamemnon is not in charge anymore.
Yeah, I know we got to stop, but let me just mention one more detail, because I love this. Maybe I should write something on this book, because I just love all this book so much. But so you remember the boxing match? It's like two guys who haven't shown up before. I think the guy who wins is called Polypoetes, right? Maker of many things or something like that. He says, oh, yeah, well, I'm a good boxer, but I'm not a really good fighter. But that's okay, because everybody is good at something. Right, there's nobody who's good at everything. And then shortly after that, we have the wrestling match where Odysseus, you know, tricks Ajax or uses skill against Ajax and wins. And then we have the foot race. And I think Odysseus also wins that. My memory is fuzzy, but I think he does also win that one. So there's this guy, apparently, who is a better wrestler than one of the biggest Greeks, and a faster runner than one of the fastest Greeks, both of whose name is Ajax, by the way, which I think just drives the point home, right? Same name, but different guy, right? The greater and the lesser Ajax. But Odysseus is better than them at their very different, both of their very different skills. So I think in this new world, this world of pity and cleverness, if I can put it that way, it might not be the case that, oh yeah, one person's good at one thing, another person's good at another thing. There's at least a possibility that there could be a guy who's good at everything. Maybe skill is something that's kind of universally applicable. And that might introduce a kind of unfairness as well, or a distortion in the justice of the situation. So, you know, that a barbarian like me would find questionable. But I know this is just another big chunk, so yeah. Sorry about that. We should end.
No, it's great. I've been working on a polymetis joke for most of the time that you were talking and listening to it, but mostly working on the joke. You know, to tee up the Odyssey. Yeah. But yeah, we are at time. Book 23 wrapped up. Thank you, Shiloh. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, dear listener. Got another subscriber recently, so thanks to everybody that's subscribing and donating to the pod. Helps us out a ton. Yeah, you can do that at combatandclassics.org. You can follow us on all the socials at Combat and Classics. You can rate us on iTunes. Helps out the show. Thanks, guys, and we'll be back for Book 24.